This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Public health experts, including the American Medical Association, are calling for an end to so-called HIV criminalization laws, laws that require people with HIV to disclose their status to sexual partners, IV drug users, and other specific groups. The thought behind the laws is that they deter HIV-positive people from spreading the virus. But today's treatment regimens can bring the virus down to near undetectable levels in some patients. And critics of the disclosure laws say that they create a culture of fear among the HIV-positive population and should be repealed, or at least reformed. Joining me now is health reporter Paige Flager. Paige is calling in from WOSU, the NPR station in Columbus, Ohio, where she's done some recent reporting on this. Paige, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So what made you interested in reporting on this?
I am a big nerd, and I was attending a health policy conference, and there was actually a panel about this, and people were discussing, it was a bunch of public health experts talking about some of the struggles with how you prove disclosure, and I guess just some of the nuances about the law, which on its face, like you were saying, I think people are like, yeah, that law makes sense. But I think when you dig a little bit deeper, it's more gray than it seems.
So what is the Ohio law that we're looking at concerning HIV? What does it say?
So Ohio actually has a couple of laws that mention HIV. The main one is called felonious assault, which is kind of this the one that you hear most about, where if you don't disclose your HIV status to a partner before you have sex, then you can be imprisoned for up to 8 years. But HIV is also mentioned when it comes to felonies regarding if you spit on someone, bite someone, if you try to donate blood and have HIV, if you are a sex worker with HIV, or if you are soliciting sex and you have HIV. So there are a lot of different laws here in our state and around the country that mention HIV. And as it stands, someone can press charges against someone even if they don't contract the virus at all.
How long has this law been on the books? When was it passed?
Yeah, so it was passed in the late 90s here in Ohio, and this was kind of part of I actually spoke with the gentleman who – the lawmaker who passed the statute, and he says that he introduced it on the advice of lawmakers – or law enforcement individuals who thought that this should be a law that was on the books. It was a law that was on the books in a lot of other states. But recently other states have started repealing these laws. And so that's something that Ohio public health experts are pushing for here as well.
What do you know about the specific reason that it was passed? Have you talked to anybody who participated in passing it other than, the gentleman who helped to write it?
No, I think, I just spoke with the man who helped to write it, and he kind of just said it was something that, like we were talking about, seemed very obvious on its face, especially in the 70s, 80s, 90s even, where HIV at the time was considered a death sentence.
And you recently reported on health modernization efforts in Ohio related to this law. Before we get into those efforts, can you explain what that term means?
Yeah, so basically it's this argument that our laws are in place and science and medicine is something that is always advancing. We're learning more and more about it every single day. And so there are laws that mention different health problems, such as like HIV, where they were put in place at a time when HIV was more serious, and the science around HIV has changed a lot. And so their argument is that the laws need to change to meet up with the science.
And you featured somebody named Greg Cote in your story. Who is Greg and how did you meet him?
So Greg was actually at the conference, and he has been living with HIV for 30 years, and he's a big advocate for pushing for these laws to change. And I just spoke with him a little bit about how these laws being in place affect him and the stigma that some of these laws can carry. And he told me that there's this fear amongst the HIV community that if you are HIV positive and you engage with a partner, even if you disclose to that partner, there's a possibility that maybe the relationship ends negatively and then that person decides that they want to press charges against you. And so he told me that he actually has completely avoided being in relationships or being intimate with anyone since he got his diagnosis, because he says that's the safest way to make sure that nothing bad happens.
And this disclosure is not easy to prove or disprove, I guess, in this case. And that's another big reason that these laws should be modernized, in some people's opinion.
Yeah, that was, I think, probably what shocked me the most when I was learning about this, was that the burden of proof for disclosure is so high that in Ohio, people who are familiar with the law say the best and most surefire way to make sure that you can prove that you disclose to your partner is to get your partner in a room with a medical provider and disclose in front of a medical provider. And so you can imagine that, one, that's a difficult conversation to have under the best circumstances, let alone in a room with your doctor. And two, that's kind of a difficult thing to set up when you're hoping to be intimate with someone. Yes. So it's pretty wild.
That's not what I'd call a normal social interaction, I guess. And you write that Greg himself is very open about his HIV positive status, and he calls himself a walking billboard. What does he do to let people know?
Yeah, when I met up with him, he was wearing his HIV shirt. He had an HIV kind of necklace. He wants everybody to know that he has HIV and that he's HIV positive, because he doesn't want to ever be put in a situation where someone can say, "You didn't tell me." And I think that kind of speaks to this culture of fear that he was talking about, that these laws are kind of hanging over people's heads. And even when you are somebody who deals with your HIV responsibly and you are on medications, like you were mentioning, to be undetectable and untransmittable, still there's this fear that someone can say, "Hey, this person never told me that they had HIV," and then that person can go to jail. Prison.
We're speaking with health reporter Paige Flager, who is joining us from WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. And Greg talks about the stigma of being HIV positive. How does he say that manifests? What effect does the stigma have on people?
Well, I think it's just that. It's this fear in every interaction. Like he was saying, even when he came to interview me, he was like, "What if I shook your hand and later something happened where you had a cut on your hand or something like that?" Then he's like, "I don't ever want to put myself in a situation where I might be endangering someone." And that's the other thing about these laws, is that they say nothing about intent. So they don't mention whether or not someone like maliciously was intending to give someone HIV. And a lot of these public health experts say if that's the case, then those people should be punished. But it's not taken into account if a person is taking medications to manage their HIV. If they are using condoms, that's not taken into account. So even if you are super responsible and very careful, these laws still scare people.
What about the other side? What recent arguments have you heard in support of the laws?
Yeah, so the laws here in Ohio have been challenged before. There was a Supreme Court case about it. And I think it's interesting, because these laws people who are in support of these laws often just say the things that I think make sense when you first hear about them, that like a person deserves to know the HIV status of the person that they're engaging with, and that part of consent is knowing exactly what you're getting into. And so if someone's HIV positive, then the other person deserves to know. And I think that argument on its face makes a lot of sense. But I think considering all of these other kind of nuances, it makes it a lot more difficult. And I think that's part of the reason that they don't want to get rid of this law altogether. What they want to do is make it so that it's more modernized and take it from being a felony to being a misdemeanor.
So is that the middle ground between these two extremes, the repeal completely or keep them on the books to modernize them?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people here in Ohio, I think the public health folks who are pushing for this, I think they would love to see a total repeal, but I think they also know that that's not necessarily feasible, especially in our state, which is sometimes a little bit more conservative. And so they're kind of just pushing for this middle ground, for it to not be a felony, for there to be account taken when it comes to disclosure, for there to be account taken when it comes to intent, for it to be taken into account whether or not someone is managing their HIV and if they're undetectable and untransmittable. But those things, as it's written now, are not part of the law.
And we do want to apologize to our listeners for some of the issues on the line. Paige, we can still hear you, but it is kind of fuzzing in and out a little bit. But I do want to ask, there's a connection here with injection drug use as well. How does that fit in?
Yeah, so some of the laws, in addition to having these HIV kind of criminalization statutes, some of the states also have kind of a part of it that says if you are sharing needles with someone. So here in Ohio, obviously, we are hit very hard by the opioid crisis. And if you share needles with someone and you're HIV positive, then you still need to disclose. And it is a felony to not disclose your HIV status if you're sharing needles with someone.
Do attitudes around disclosure seem different with injection drug use? Do people stick to the same camps on that issue?
It's interesting because I think it's an HIV among injection drug users is not something that there's kind of a movement right now to try and talk about that and to address that more, because when we think of HIV, I think stereotypically there's this concept that it impacts the LGBTQ community, specifically gay men and people of color. And so when we pivot to look at injection drug users, we're also looking at kind of poor, rural, white people. And so there's kind of an effort in the public health world to pivot a little bit from managing the LGBTQ population and HIV and looking at our injection drug users, especially as the opioid crisis becomes more prominent.
We really appreciate you taking the time today. Health reporter Paige Flager will be back with us after the break. Up next, we'll bring in new voices to talk about HIV laws and efforts to modernize them in Indiana and around the country. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. What do you think of these laws? Would you want them to change in some way? Why or why not? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to our conversation on efforts to change HIV-related laws, I want to tell you about our last show. We talked to Axton Betts Hamilton, an expert on child identity theft, who herself lived through a long, strange case of identity theft. You can find that show and all our shows wherever you get podcasts. Just search for All In. Today, we're talking about efforts to reform laws that impact people with HIV in Indiana, Ohio, and many states around the country. As always, we'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining us from WOSU, the NPR affiliate in Columbus, Ohio, we're joined again by health reporter Paige Flager. She's done some recent reporting on reform efforts happening there. And we're bringing in two new people into the discussion. On the phone from New York is Jada Hicks. Jada works for the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Thanks for joining us, Jada.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And finally, in the studio, we have Carrie Foote. Carrie is an associate professor of sociology at the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
We're going to start with you. Can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got involved in efforts to reform HIV laws in Indiana?
Sure. Well, it started when I tested positive, I would say, in 1988. I've been living with HIV for over 30 years. And since testing positive when I was a teenager and I went back to college, I kind of turned everything I studied, everything I did, I made a project around HIV. So here I ended up in Indiana as a professor of sociology, my expertise in HIV, in stigma, and very much interested in the lived experience of people living with HIV. And through that work, I discovered that people living with HIV faced unjust prosecution under laws around the world, not just in Indiana and the United States, but globally. And through that, I kind of started in 2016 with another group of people living with HIV in the state of Indiana. We developed this network called the HIV Modernization Movement Indiana, which aimed to modernize Indiana's unjust and outdated laws that basically unjustly criminalize people living with HIV and don't reflect changes in modern science since I tested positive in the late 80s.
And we heard from Paige about what it has been done and what they're doing in Ohio. How does Indiana compare?
So our laws are very similar. They're different, but they're also very similar. We also have a law that criminalizes people for alleged non-disclosure of their HIV status prior to engaging in any sexual act that could possibly transmit HIV, as well as using a needle with somebody when you're HIV positive without disclosing. We also have laws against criminalizing people for attempting to donate blood products. And just to be very clear, our blood supply is safe. There's just no way you can contract HIV from the blood supply these days. And then we also have sentence enhancement laws that deal with bodily fluids of people. Anybody in the state of Indiana could be charged with a crime for, let's say, spitting aggressively on another person. But for someone who doesn't have HIV, that crime is a misdemeanor. So it's a minor crime. But for someone with HIV as well as hepatitis, it's a felony offense, even though we all know that spit doesn't transmit HIV. So it's basically the person's health status on why they're being prosecuted under these laws.
What impact do these laws have on people? Some argue, of course, that the laws help protect people from HIV. Why do you and others say that they're actually harmful?
So I've done a lot of research on this. A lot of people who study these issues have done research, and there's been an incredible amount of research out there to try to understand, are there any public health benefit to having laws that criminalize folks? And what we find is not one study has uncovered any kind of public health benefit that these laws actually help prevent HIV. What we are finding is increasingly support that the laws contribute to stigma and other barriers that keep people that, from knowing their status, from seeking health care and getting the proper care that they need to live well lives. And we do know that people can do very well with HIV. The life expectancy is almost just as long as anybody else who doesn't have HIV. We also now know that treatment is prevention. When I'm, for example, treated with my HIV and I have an undetectable status, which I do, it's basically impossible for me to transmit HIV sexually. This is incredible science. I can actually donate an organ to another person living with HIV and be a living organ donor these days. But yet we have these laws that tell us we are a potential criminal. And even myself, who's very open about my HIV status, I could get into a horrible breakup with my partner, and he could use these laws against me to say, well, I'm going to go and say you didn't disclose to me when we first got into a relationship, and try to, enact revenge against me to try to harm me. So there's incredible harm, and particularly for women living with HIV, disclosure can be very complicated, especially if they're in abusive relationships. They risk violence if they disclose their HIV status. So they can be caught between a rock and a hard place. When you have a law that they could face felony convictions for non-disclosure, but yet if they disclose, they could potentially risk severe violence in their lives. But what they can do is they can get into care, they can get treatment, they could use a condom, and they can basically, take care of themselves as well as protect their partners without ever having to disclose their status. Disclosure is not seen as an effective HIV prevention measure. It's encouraged when it's safe to do so, to have open dialogue about a person's sexual health and well-being, but not mandated by the law. That can increase incredible harms.
Jada,
it's also important to keep in mind that in terms of these specific HIV criminal laws and public health goals, we know that for almost all of these laws, and I think all of them, one of the elements is that you have to have knowledge of your HIV status. And so anecdotally, we've heard that there is this disincentive to get tested, because if you get tested and know your status, you then can be subject to prosecution. And it opens the door for that.
We're hearing Jada Hicks, who is calling in from New York. She is with the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Jada, can you quickly describe what the Center for HIV Law and Policy is and what you do there?
Sure, I definitely can. I am a staff attorney at the Center for HIV Law and Policy. We work as a national policy resource center that challenges barriers to the rights and health of people affected by HIV. And we do this through legal advocacy, high-impact policy initiatives, and creation of cross-issue partnerships, networks, and resources. And so I specifically do that through our Positive Justice Project work. So I work a lot with states and individual state coalitions to try and reform their HIV-specific criminal laws.
How common are the laws like the one we've been talking about around the country?
So I definitely think they're more common than people realize. There are over 30 states currently that criminalize HIV in some form or fashion. Now, that can be through kind of the things that we've touched on a little bit on the call already. So it could be through HIV-specific criminal laws. It could be through an enhancement for individuals living with HIV that engage in sex work. It could be for blood or organ donation, sharing needles. It could also be a sentence enhancement based on HIV status. We even have states that still use the general criminal code to prosecute individuals for HIV-related offenses. So, you know, reckless endangerment, we've even seen attempted murder charges. While rare, we have seen the general code used to prosecute someone living with HIV in that fashion.
How long have these laws been around? We know that Ohio's law has been around since 99. Did this all start happening at a certain point years ago?
So basically what happened is the federal government conditioned funding through the Ryan White Care Act on whether a state had these types of laws in effect. And so they were mostly adopted during that time period. And I think it's important to think about what was going on during this period as well. So we still didn't understand HIV and AIDS in general. We didn't know the roots and risk of transmission. And not only that, we didn't know how to treat it. There wasn't an effective treatment regime out there. And so that was the backdrop for how all of these laws were drafted and introduced and put on the books. And we just haven't gone back and circled back to update them to really put them in line with current medical research, data, and science.
Paige, we talked earlier about the intersection between these kinds of laws and injection drug use. There's also a connection with solicitation and prostitution. How do HIV laws there affect the charges for these things?
So essentially, I mean, Columbus has a big human trafficking problem. Obviously, we are impacted by IV drug use. I think it's some 4,000 people in Columbus are using injectable drugs every day, and so there are a lot of opportunities for someone with HIV to potentially be in a situation where they're using a needle and sharing with somebody else. And so, like Jada was touching on, it can be an enhancement of the law as it stands. So if you are soliciting, you get one kind of charge. And if you are soliciting with HIV, then that can be significantly worse.
Karen.
Just to add another dimension of injecting drug use, in Indiana, what we see is people are not really charged under our non-disclosure laws around injection drug use. What we see is for the sentence enhancement laws around battery by bodily fluid is that often people living with hepatitis C, some of them may also have HIV, face sentence enhancement charges, and many of those individuals are people who inject drugs. And it can be a situation just where a police officer is engaged in an arrest of somebody who is someone who injects drugs, And in the process of being arrested, the person may get upset, spit may come out of their mouth, and all of a sudden they face a sentence enhancement charge under their original charges for battery by bodily fluid while living with hepatitis C. So here we've added this horrible felony conviction, which wreaks havoc on people's lives and makes their lives even more difficult and complicated, when really what this person needs is care and support around their substance, you know, use disorder. And now we're throwing them in jail. And really, again, what we're doing is, you know, we're taking a public health problem of the problem of the, let's say, opioid crisis or methamphetamine use crisis of around people who inject drugs in the state of Indiana who also may have hepatitis C, and we're criminalizing them when we really should be taking a public health approach, providing them support and care. And again, spit does not transmit either HIV or hepatitis C. You just don't get it that way. And it's just another example of how we need to update the science and the laws.
We're talking about modernizing HIV laws. And Carrie, you introduced legislation this past spring, and it didn't pass. What happened?
Right. So it was Representative Edward Clare, who was the author on the modernization legislation this previous spring. And we were kind of... We didn't address all our laws. It's complicated in Indiana because we have so many different laws, mixture of public health and criminal law. Our goal was to address some of the criminalization issues around attempting to donate blood products, around the disclosure law, as well as eliminating stigmatizing language in our laws and outdated use of terms like the term ARC, AIDS-related complex, which has no meaning at all. It's a term that's outdated, carried over from the 80s. Modernize things like the use of the term AIDS when people talk about you contract HIV. That's inaccurate. You contract HIV. I mean, you don't contract AIDS. You contract HIV. So we were trying to modernize language. We were trying to modernize science. And then we were also addressing some of our criminal law. I think we had incredible success in our legislative body. We actually got 100% support for our bill as it went out of the House into the Senate. And to me, that is just remarkable and amazing, and shows that we can do incredible modernization work in the state of Indiana, that our legislators are supportive of modernization. There's still a lot of education that needs to happen around just basic HIV 101, where some folks are still hesitant. They don't quite understand the science. So we had some challenges in our Senate committee, and it just kind of told us we need to educate people more. They just don't quite understand how things have changed from the 80s. There's still a lot of misunderstandings about HIV, a lot of stigma and a lot of fear. And it's just going to take a little bit more time, and we will be introducing more modernization legislation this spring, and very hopeful that we'll get something passed, because we're doing a really good job educating not just the arena of public health, but also working with the Indiana State Prosecutors Association, as well as our legislative bodies here in Indiana.
Jada, can you give us a breakdown of how reform efforts have gone across the country? How many have succeeded, and roughly how many have failed?
Yes, so we've had about 7 states that have reformed and or repealed their HIV-specific acts. I don't have exact numbers on how many have failed, but I would say probably quite a few. It's definitely a long process. You have to get buy-in from a various number of stakeholders, like Carrie was saying, you know, prosecutors, getting defense attorneys on board, getting the Department of Public Health. And really, most of the aims of the reform efforts have a common goal, which is to make sure that the harm is proportionate to the crime, right? So currently, most of these punishment levels are felony-level punishments just based on disease status. And that doesn't take into account whether or not transmission has occurred. It doesn't take into account whether there were risk reduction measures used, such as condoms or other prophylactic devices. It also doesn't take into account whether or not a person on treatment and virally suppressed and cannot transmit. And so really most of the reform efforts throughout the country are focusing on trying to incorporate some sort of specific intent, requiring specific intent in order to prosecute. Some states are looking to require transmission, and also trying to take into account if an individual does take risk reduction measures. So that's a common theme that we see through most of the reform efforts throughout the country.
Are there trends you've noticed when you look at reform efforts that don't work out, common reasons why they don't ultimately pass?
Yes, so I think part of that depends on where we're talking about in the country, right, where we're situated. Sometimes the prosecutor's offices give a little bit of pushback. Sometimes they're very supportive and on board and leading the charge. So it really depends on kind of the political makeup sometimes and whether you have the public health department on board or not. But a number of barriers have to be overcome, and I would say the biggest one is stigma and the lack of education that surrounds HIV. People still think of it as a death sentence. They still don't understand how it's transmitted. They still don't understand, for instance, that spit can't transmit or that when you're virally suppressed, you can't transmit. And so I think the biggest barrier to all reform efforts across the country is really that lack of education and that stigma that's so pervasive.
Paige, we have less than a minute, but what's your sense been while reporting on this about how educated people are about these laws and the effect that they have, especially people outside of the communities that are directly affected by them? Are people generally aware of this issue?
No. I would say that almost anybody who I've talked to about this story and who heard the story was very surprised. And I think what Jada was saying rings true here in Ohio, that there before these public health experts are even going to try and introduce something into law, they're meeting with lawmakers one-on-one, educating them on the science, what the CDC says, what the American Medical Association has said, and hoping that that education will kind of be the bedrock for future reform.
I want to thank all of our guests for joining us today. Paige Flager is a health reporter at WOSU in Columbus, Ohio. Thank you, Paige.
Thank you.
Jada Hicks works for the Center for HIV Law and Policy. Thank you, Jada.
Thank you so much.
And Carrie Foote, an associate professor of sociology at the IUPUI School of Liberal Arts. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Up next, we'll talk to two people from the Damien Center, an Indianapolis group that serves people with HIV and AIDS, about the one-stop shop model they've implemented there. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on HIV issues in Indiana. We've been talking so far about efforts to reform HIV laws in states like Indiana and Ohio. Now we're zooming in a little to talk about a specific organization in Indianapolis that serves people with HIV and AIDS. It's called the Damien Center, and we're joined by its CEO, Alan Witchie. Thanks for coming, Alan.
Thanks for having us.
And Nick Sanders is here. Nick is the Prevention Program Manager at the Damien Center. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
Let's jump right in. Alan, the Damien Center is well-known in Indianapolis, but for people who don't know about it and people listening around the state, what does the Damien Center do?
Sure. We're the state's oldest and largest HIV/AIDS service provider. So we've been around for about 33 years now. And our focus is on a sort of a comprehensive one-stop shop model. What we know is that the more often patients or clients need to go from one location to another, the less likely they are to sort of follow through services. And so we try to offer as many services as we can under one roof. We have a medical clinic, we have mental health care, substance use counseling. We have linkage to care for people who need help getting into care. We have a food pantry, housing services, case management, sort of a very large scope of services under one roof.
How long has it been around?
So we've been around for about 33 years now. And we started, you know, when we started in the early years, this was really about helping people die with dignity. So there were people that were oftentimes coming in the door. They were rejected from their families. They weren't accepted in the community, and they needed help. And so we were doing things at the time just really helping people die with dignity because there weren't medications. There weren't options for people. And we've really evolved. Now we have great medications so people can live a very normal, ordinary life. And it's an exciting time, but they still oftentimes have other complications related to the disease or to their life in other ways.
You provide a variety of services. How do you get funding?
Sure. Well, we get funding in different ways. So we have federal funds that are funneled through the state. Those can come from places like the CDC or Health and Human Services. We also have funding through the county, also funnel that comes from the federal level. And then we have grants that we write to foundations. We have individuals. We do events. Like, we have a grand masquerade once a year. That's a nice gala event where people can come, and we raise a lot of money there. So we really have a diverse funding stream.
And volunteers are a big part of the Damien Center, right?
Yeah. You know, volunteers are the heart of how we started. I mean, that's at the beginning of this epidemic. We didn't have very many staff, and so we really needed volunteers to come in and really do things. And now a volunteer is still a critical part of what we do. Our volunteers run our food pantry, for instance, and help serve over 500 families every month in the food pantry that otherwise would just not have enough food to eat on a daily basis. They help out in various different ways, from planning the gala I mentioned to day-to-day activities. So it's really great having people step up and volunteer.
How many volunteers do you work with the Damien Center?
You know, that's a great question. I should have counted them before I came.
I'm sure it changes a lot.
I know we have somewhere around 200 to 300, I think, every year.
Hmm. And can you give us a sense for how the Damien Center fits in central Indiana to the different groups and organizations trying to address similar issues? Are there a ton of groups like yours all over the Indianapolis area, or just a few big ones?
Well, they're across the state. There are sort of there's a network of nonprofit agencies that are similar to the Damien Center in some ways, that are doing the same kind of work. So if you're in Fort Wayne, there's Positive Link. If you're in Evansville, there's an organization there, and so on. And so they're all over. Wherever you are in the state, you can access, usually in a metropolitan center near you, services, and many of us also provide services in rural communities. So we have about people from 52 different counties come and access our services. So many people who don't want to access in their local community or need help. But as nonprofits, we only offer what we can sort of manage. So different services, sort of organizations might offer different services. Some may not offer mental health services directly on site. Like, we have staff that are counselors, where some other sites might sort of coordinate with another organization like Volunteers of America or a local mental health organization that brings the mental health services on site. But I think we all know that the key is trying to offer as much as possible under one roof. And that's different than a lot of the hospitals. So, for instance, there are a lot of hospitals that do HIV care. Many of them are really focused on the medical side of things and will kind of, focus on that area and then work with us and other agencies to help provide some additional supportive services that they aren't able to do, like housing, for instance.
Nick, you're the prevention program manager. What is that job? What do you do?
For prevention, what it typically involves is that it will involve solutions like testing, PrEP, which is a pre-exposure prophylaxis, so it's a pill you can take once a day every day, actually prevents from someone from contracting the HIV virus if they were to be exposed by it. It's very effective, up to 99% effective. It's backed by the CDC and other health organizations to be a very effective preventative measurement for anyone that might be at high risk for HIV, but also additionally getting testing. So the CDC recommends that everyone at some point in their life be tested at least once if you're at a high risk, in a high risk group, particularly once every 3 months. And it's something that is regulated, it's preferred, because knowing your status can be a very powerful thing. So helping to promote and educate individuals about what HIV is and also how to prevent it is a type of prevention that I typically focus on.
And you have to think somewhere between 1 in 7 to 1 in 5 people who have HIV don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So these efforts are really important to get people to know their status and make sure that they're getting into care early, because, as Nick mentioned, if you're in care and you're taking your medications appropriately, you can live a very healthy life, and you can also no longer pass on the virus to other people if your viral load is undetectable. And that's a really exciting place to be. We have medications on both sides of the equation, if you will. So for people who are high risk negative, if they're on a medication, they can not get the virus if they're exposed to it. And if you're HIV positive and you're taking it and your viral load is suppressed, then you won't pass on the virus. virus.
We've been talking about efforts to reform some of the HIV disclosure laws in Indiana and other states. Nick, have you seen these laws have an impact on the people you serve in any way?
Absolutely, especially for my serodiscordant couples. So individuals where one is HIV positive, the other one is HIV negative. These are individuals that can be stigmatized by having to disclose their status. And being able to maybe reform these laws to be able to provide dignity, provide not such a focus, like this is, HIV status is just one small part to an individual as far as, but with how our current laws are now, it's can be very stigmatizing, it can be criminalizing, and it's something that needs to change because it's not how it used to be. So we've made huge strides both in medicine, but also in social movements, that HIV virus is manageable. It is no longer a death sentence, and that we shouldn't have to criminalize individuals just because of their status.
Alan, same question to you. What do you make of the disclosure laws around HIV in Indiana?
Well, I think, you know, the disclosure laws were written in a very different time period. I think oftentimes when people didn't really even understand HIV or how to get it. I mean, in this state when you can be, you know, prosecuted for spitting, if you have HIV and you spit on somebody, you can be prosecuted for that, which is not possible to transmit. You know, you can't transmit the virus that way. Well, that's just sort of crazy that you can still have these antiquated laws that aren't relevant to the science today, the way that we know it. So there's certainly a need for revision because the science no longer matches the laws. They were written at a time period when we just didn't know a lot. And so people were very scared and they were afraid. And it's time for them to be updated for sure.
Can one of you give us kind of a broad overview, a sense for where Indiana is right now with HIV? What are some of the major factors that have made things better or maybe worse for the spread of HIV and our response to it in recent years?
Sure. When you think about it, in this state, we have about 12,000 people with HIV, AIDS, and that, you know, so we aren't necessarily an epicenter as a state. But in Marion County, we certainly have a much higher rate. And in the federal government has identified sort of the 50 key areas that are sort of the hot spots or the epidemic growth. And so that is certainly Marion County is amongst them. But the rest of the state is not. However, as a state and certainly as, again, as Marion County, there are very high rates of sexually transmitted diseases. And that's indicative oftentimes of HIV rates that will come through. We know that in this state, we had the outbreak in Scott County a few years ago. And that is made national news because we had such a large growth. And that could happen here in the state again. That could happen here in various different places because of we haven't really adapted the laws and done the outreach and interventions in the way we need to as a state.
And we're talking with the CEO of the Damien Center in Indianapolis, Alan Witchy, and their prevention program manager, Nick Sanders. Alan, you've said that there are probably 1,000 people in this city that are HIV positive and don't even know it.
Correct.
Why do you think that? How do you come to numbers like that when you're talking about missing information?
Well, it's so what we do know is based on working with the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention on a federal level, they're able to look at how communities in general see HIV rates come in and where people test positive and where there might be gaps. And so we look at those numbers directly with data from the CDC, and they are estimating at least 1,000 people here in central Indiana. And there's, again, one to five to one to seven people who have HIV who don't know it. Generally speaking, those are people that are, you know, not coming in to get tested, but are engaging some kind of high risk behavior. So they're having unprotected sex, they're using drugs, needle sharing with drugs. Those are the two primary infection methods. But this disease really hits the African-American community very strongly, too. And so a lot of African-American women have been coming in the new rounds of people who are positive, as well as very young people. So we see a lot of growth amongst young people ages 18 to, you know, 29 who don't know about the epidemic in the early days. They might have misperceptions about how easy it is to try to take care of take the medications and get the medications. And so there's a lot of youth and certainly ethnic, racial minorities that are really being affected on a large scale in the new infections.
You kicked off the segment by calling the Damien Center a one-stop shop. Is this a model that you've adopted recently?
No, you know, it's been our goal since the beginning. And we know this because research from nonprofits are really clear. And it's not just nonprofits. It's medical models, any kind of service provision, that most people that go in for whatever the presenting issue is, right? So maybe I'm coming in for food. And then maybe when I come in for food, people say like, oh, you also have this medical condition. So let's get you to a medical provider. And so they'll make a referral and say, hey, here's where you go. You know, you might even make a map or give them an address or make a call and set them up. But there's still somewhere around 50% of people in the country, as well as those our stats are true here too, that who don't make that follow-up referral. So a large number of people don't do the follow-up because they get caught up in their everyday life and problems and things that are happening. And so what we found is that the more services we can offer under one roof, the more likely we are to address holistically the issues that somebody has. So if they're coming in for food and they can get their medical care at the same place and then get their mental health care at the same place and they can get their housing assistance from the same place, it makes it easier for everyone. They're far more likely to follow through. And what we know is that why that's important is that if you look at sort of social determinants of health models, we know that medical in itself, going to your medical care, your doctor, your physician, doesn't really solve a lot of the other problems in your life that affect your health. And so in order to have healthy life, you have to have stability in housing. In order to have healthy life, you have to also have food on the table. And if you're missing those things, especially housing and food, then you're far less likely to be stable and have a stable medical condition.
This idea, though, of offering a lot of services to people, not just turning them away or giving them a little information about where else they can go, has caught on in certain service and advocacy arenas, like the wraparound service,
right,
is often said to be crucial for helping homeless people transition into permanent housing, a world that you used to work in.
Right.
What are the big obstacles to actually implementing these models, though? It sounds great on paper, but is it always a realistic goal?
Right. Well, you know, it's not realistic for every organization. I think that it's very intensive and complicated to manage, and it can be very expensive. You know, every service you're going to offer, you have to have a funding source for it. You have to figure out how you're going to pay for it. And so I think even organizations that oftentimes want to offer more comprehensive services struggle because they're trying to figure out, well, how am I going to pay it? And even if I get money for it this year, how am I going to sustain it into the next year and the next year and the next year? And so I think one of the things that we've been really fortunate to be able to do is figure out how to balance that and really figure out, okay, well, if we're going to have a medical model, how do we make sure that we get the expenses covered so that we don't have to worry about whether we're going to offer it in the next year and the year after and so on? And that can be complicated. It's a very complicated thing to run a medical clinic and to run a housing program and to run a comprehensive mental health program and a food program and so on. So you also have to have the infrastructure to manage that, and that can be really difficult.
Nick, same question to you. How do you balance the goal of offering people everything they need with the reality of your budget, especially in the world of nonprofits that you inhabit, where funding can be unpredictable?
I think the best way that we can best manage both our services as well as the funding streams that we have is by constantly keeping an eye out for what funding streams that we do have to offer, while also doing the best as far as assessing the needs of our clients. So if in an ideal sense, I would love to provide every single service to every client that I can whenever I can. But sometimes we may have to prioritize services, or like if maybe I can't provide this service right this very moment, maybe I provide a referral so those services can also be provided to that person in the moment, so they don't have to wait for funding stream, so that they don't have to wait for some sort of response. They can have that response right this moment, and then constantly budgeting, just being able to prioritize where our funding needs to go, who needs to go towards, and then also making sure that it's sustainable for a longer period of time, whether that be annually, every 6 months, at monthly, however we need to manage it to make sure it best suits the clients in that way.
In our last 30 seconds, Alan, the federal government announced a push last year to end the HIV epidemic. What does that look like? Has it had any effect?
Well, we're just underway for a planning process that will start in this year and kick that off because that starts next year. It's 10 years from starting in January. And I think it's really exciting. It's an exciting opportunity to think that we can. We have the resources, the time, the effort, and the knowledge to end this epidemic, and we can.
Alan Witchie, CEO of the Damien Center in Indianapolis, thank you for taking the time today.
Thank you.
Nick Sanders, Prevention Program Manager at the Damien Center, thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Get the podcast wherever you get podcasts. And tomorrow is our Friday Pitch-In, where we catch up on the biggest Indiana headlines of the week. And we'll hear from Pete the Planner, who's offering free financial advice to displaced Celadon employees following their sudden bankruptcy this week. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. And I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.